Those of you who know of Abner's work will know that he's an economic historian, and he's currently Ciccelli Professor of Economic History at the University of Oxford. I hope I've pronounced that right. I woke up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat wondering how to pronounce that word. He's also a Fellow of All Souls College at Oxford and a member of the British Academy. He's previously worked at the universities of Cambridge, the Australian National University, New York and Rutgers Universities in the States, and just today told me also York University. And if you look at his list of research interests, I mean, they read to me like a compendium of the things that we really ought to have been worried about in the 20th century. The social and economic context of war, land tenure, rural and urban economy, the legal context for social and economic history. And if you go and look at on Wikipedia, you'll find that he's published very widely in all of these areas. But over the past 10 years, his main interest has been in post-war economic growth, and particularly growth in affluent societies, and particularly the challenges which such affluence presents to well-being. And his most recent book, you might know, published in 2006, is called The Challenge of Affluence, Self-Control and Well-being in the United States and Britain since 1950. And if you've not read it, you're in for a treat. And the reviews of this book, if you read them, caused Will Hutton, who I know many of you will know, to describe Abner Offer as one of Britain's most subtle thinkers about how we live today. And in my email exchanges and inviting him here, I've also found him, on top of all that, to be quite a nice bloke as well. Though he disputes that, which says volumes. So I know that he's going to draw upon all of that experience as he talks to us today and ask the question, should governments try to make us happy, Professor Abner Offer?
Well, first, thank you all for coming here. It's always a pleasure to come to Glasgow. I've done that several times now. And I look forward to the conversation with the audience here. Should government make us happy? First, I should say, a lot of this comes out of this recent book. It is also available in paperback. At a rather lower price, and on the face of it, it would seem to have been overtaken by events pretty rapidly, in that I think that the challenge facing us is possibly the opposite of affluence. Nevertheless, there's an enduring issue here. So what am I going to talk about? First, what is happiness? I put happiness in quotes. Happiness is not what you and me think of as happiness, but what social scientists think of as happiness. Second, what is government meant to be doing in general? And what is government meant to be doing about happiness? But really, what is government meant to be doing in general? Perhaps I should say that I'm also booked to give another talk tomorrow, which will be much more about this. And the title of that talk is The Economy of Obedience, of Obligation, Incomplete Contracts and the Welfare State. So it sounds a little technical, but the argument is that markets can't work in the welfare domain because contracts are not reliable. That's just the general thrust of it. So if you're interested, you can come to that as well. How relevant is it in the present crisis? So should we now forget about happiness? Well, in a way, government is extremely concerned to keep us happy. You know, this great gamble, as the Guardian calls it today, is really about keeping us cheerful, going to the shops, buying for Christmas and so on, hopefully ignoring that the temple is collapsing around our ears. And finally, my own take. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about is other people's work, but in the end I'm going to provide a bit of my own take, which is largely about myopia and self-control, that dimension of happiness. There's been a rising tide of policy concern about happiness. The king of Bhutan is the leader in this. So he said as early as 1972, the primary objective of development should be gross national happiness. Not gross national product, but gross national happiness. Two leading psychologists, well-being has become a primary focus of policymakers. Its rigorous measurement is a primary policy imperative. So we need to measure happiness somehow to incorporate this into policy. Richard Layard, who is quite influential in, used to be quite influential in New Labour circles, we should monitor the development of happiness as closely as we monitor the development of income. And finally, Kahneman and Kruger. Kahneman is a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in economics, and Kruger is a notable economist. And he says, the acceptance of national well-being index as a complement to the national income and product account. So all of these people are saying, well, for the last 50, 60 years, we've been using, we've been managing our economy using the national accounts. Now we need, that doesn't measure everything we need to go beyond that into measuring well-being in some way or other in order to guide policy. Now, I want to talk about four approaches to well-being. Actually, it's not going to be exactly this. I have all these different lectures, so they sometimes get mixed with each other. I'm going to talk about several approaches to well-being. Extended accounts, social indicators, hedonic dynamics. I'm not going to talk about capabilities, but I'm going to talk about something else. So let's start with extended accounts. Extended accounts start with the national accounts. As you know, the national accounts measure the aggregate economic activity in the economy, give us a measure of aggregate economic activity known as GDP, gross domestic product. So what is the procedure? The procedure is to take the national accounts and extend them to determinants, other determinants of well-being apart from income. Now, gross domestic product, this is gross domestic product per head in the UK from 1950. Now, the measurement of gross national product includes lots of things which aren't actually goods, they're bads. For example, if you have more road accidents and you have more emergency services, their product actually is counted as a benefit in the national account. So there is this exercise carried out in many countries to derive what this acronym is for. Index of socioeconomic welfare, yes. So once you subtract the bad, now what are the bads? The bads are things like commuting, things like the military. Some of them are a bit questionable, the cost of divorce. There are various technical items, and you end up with a much shallower curve here, which has been more or less stagnant from the 1970s. If you add resource depletion, then real income has actually been decreasing. This has been done for many countries. This is the UK. Then there's another issue with the gross national product, and that is that a lot of the productive work, yes, it only measures market and government contributions to welfare, but a lot of the work of society takes place in households. That's not measured. So if we add the contribution of households, that's quite big. These are different ways of measuring it. You can see I have two measurements here for the United States. It's in the order of between, say, 20 to 45% of GDP. So the domestic economy is very big. But it's not usually measured in the national accounts. A third thing we should add is possibly leisure, because when we choose leisure, we actually sacrifice income. So that suggests that we value it more than income, therefore we really ought to measure it, and that's an exercise. So this keeps GNP in this case constant, and this measures leisure, the blue measures leisure, the yellow measures housework. So you can see that overall, the national income economy provides a minority of our welfare. Most of our welfare comes from outside the market. Actually, if we just throw these two elements in, leisure and housework, and I could throw in the public sector as well, which is actually measured in GDP, and you'll see that public sector is about 40% of GDP in most advanced countries. So you can see that the market really provides quite a minuscule part of well-being as measured even in national accounting terms. So that's the extended accounts approach. We start with a national accounting framework and we add various things. We still measure them in dollars, pounds, in this country, yes? So we still measure it in dollars, and it's a standard national accounting framework. Another approach is not to use an accounting approach, but to use social indicators. You can think of social indicators as normative entitlements. These are things that everybody should have. The framework of this work is non-accounting. In other words, it's not a balance sheet approach, it's just a measurement of things that everybody should have, and the bias in the literature is on developing countries. So what do we see there? First, there's a non-linear relation. Each dot here is a country, and this is called the Index of Social Progress. It's derived by someone called Estes. And you can see a typical relationship here, which is that the relation between income here and social progress is non-linear. It bends like a knee, if you wish. What are these things? These are various indices here, and that's what's being measured here in the aggregate. Here's another one. This one is called... this is 20 indicators, rank of mean rankings, by someone called Slotier. Again, this is income per head. And you can see the same type of relationship. And the things we measure here are all these good things. So social indicators are good things. And some of them are, we can have bad things as well, but for simplicity, we have only good things here. Or a low score is a bad thing and a high score is a good thing. And you can see that there's a diminishing return to income in this. Here's another one. This is Index of Physical Quality of Life. This is just three things. This is life expectation, infant mortality, and education. So again, you can see this type of relationship. You might reflect what happens when we start going backwards along this curve. If in fact income decreases, what happens then? And the story here is that loss affects us about twice as strongly as gain. So actually moving backwards on this is not recommended. Nevertheless, you can see that moving forwards provides really diminishing returns. Some of the richest countries are not those that score highest. You can see some pretty rich countries that score much less than much poorer countries behind. So it really doesn't depend on income all that much. So, richer is not much better. I've already mentioned the symmetry of loss and gain. A third approach is the dynamic of hedonic experiences. Instead of looking at measurable indicators, we look into people's head. We try to understand what is the nature of the well-being as experienced individually. And here we have a standard measure which has been around for about 60 years now. And it's a response to a question. And the question is something like this. Taking all things together, would you say you are very happy, quite happy, not very happy, not at all happy? Or all things considered, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole? And we measure the responses to this question on a scale from 1 to 4, from 1 to 3, 1 to 4, 1 to 7, 1 to 10, something of that sort. You might say this is a pretty daft way to measure happiness. And I have to agree, except that it has certain advantages. So when I talk about happiness for the next few minutes, that's mostly what I'm going to talk about. So if I was in the United States, I'd call it happiness. Nevertheless, that's what we're talking about. One of the big advantages is that this question has been asked hundreds of thousands of times in more than 100 countries over 60 years, so we have very rich data on this. Now, that immediately raises the question, does money buy happiness? happiness measured in this modest, not terribly meaningful way, does economic growth improve the human lot? And the reason why this is important is that economic growth is a prime test of economic performance. Once again, we're now facing a very slight decline in national income, and the whole country, the whole world is in a serious panic about this. So is that an appropriate way to measure economic performance? What is at stake? Well, there are two views here. One is the right. Right, not in the sense of correct, but in the sense of right wing. So the argument is that money does buy happiness, and therefore that justifies business as usual and market liberalism. So they would like to find the right, I shouldn't say them and us, this is an attempt to demonstrate that money actually does buy happiness. And the other is, on the left, the view is, or there's a disposition to say that it doesn't. And this constitutes a rejection of market outcomes as the sole or even the prime measure of well-being. So there's a left and right angle to this. Okay, so let's look at some of the findings. This is all these happiness scores, yes? Remember, what is happiness? Happiness is a response to a survey questionnaire on a 7-point scale. That's what happiness is. Tell that to your children. So, one thing about happiness is that it doesn't seem to vary all that much. So, this is a measurement of this happiness question from 1946 until about 1990. This is the United States, this is Japan. In this period, the United States becomes about 3 times as wealthy, Japan becomes about 7 times as wealthy, France is there in the middle. You can see that that prosperity has not nudged happiness in either of these places very much. So it doesn't seem to have a great deal of effect. Here's another one. This is just for the UK. This is GDP in the UK between 1973 and 2002. And this is life satisfaction. So you can see life satisfaction has not been affected very strongly by economic growth. It's not as simple as that, actually, because you might well ask yourself what would have happened had GDP not increased in that way. Maybe it's necessary for GDP to increase exponentially simply to keep us at a constant level of happiness. That idea is called the hedonic treadmill. We need to continue running faster and faster just to stay in the same place. Remember, this is just the happiness I talked about. Here's another one. This is the United States. So this is mean happiness, and this is GDP per head. So GDP rises very substantially, and happiness remains stable. This is from 1975 to 2000. And finally, this is an international graph, which again shows this nonlinear relationship. These are various countries. Each dot is a country. And you can see that economic growth promotes happiness in conditions of indigence. I think there's very little question about this, that when you're very poor, if what you're interested in is in happiness thus measured, then economic growth is a high priority. But you get out of this fairly early. You can see there's some very poor countries here that score as high or higher than the United States over here. And many countries which are much poorer, which score quite respectably. Okay, so why should we care about happiness thus measured? The main reason is that statistical research over all of these decades have shown that the determinants are very robust. This is taken off in earnest only really in the 90s, but there's a very interesting precursor of all this, with a study which is done in the United States, which anticipated all the findings. It's virtually the same parameters there, but it's also presented graphically in a very neat way, in that what they show in this graph is the effect of particular attributes of an individual on the divergence from the mean, from the happiness mean. So let's look at this, and the white one is the raw score, and the black one is corrected for income. So let's look at here. This is the United States, so you can see that being black in the United States, this is negative and this is positive. Being black in the United States is not a good thing, so that's a source of unhappiness. Education. Interesting, the worst condition to be in is some college. College dropout is the worst situation. All the others, age. Consolation for those of us getting on, that older looks better, except that we are much poorer when we're old. So that kind of undermines it. And being young is apparently the worst, contrary to what you might think. Women and men, there's no difference between women and men. This is really quite remarkable. If anything, women are just a little bit happier. This is the most interesting one. So, unemployed, this is by far the biggest source of unhappiness. The other is metropolitan living. You can see the bigger the city, the more unhappiness. The third is separation, or loneliness if you wish. So unhappiness arises from social exclusion, personal isolation, happiness from social connection. So social connection, these are very robust findings. They're found again and again. Whenever these surveys are taken in advanced society. So that's why I think this is a valuable approach. There's a rather disturbing finding that in most advanced societies, most people are unreasonably happy. So, 1957, most people very happy, the rest are fairly happy, and very few people are not happy. 2005, about the same score. This is a BBC survey. This is another survey. Percentage of the population, these are the answers. This is the scale, so the modal scale is number 6 here. Most people are almost extremely happy. And you can see there is the number of people who are unhappy is rather small. And here's another one. So this is from the United States. You can see that this is a happiness score. This is an income score. So there's a small group of people who are poor and are unhappy, and all the rest seem to be doing okay, more or less. So that's an important finding in this literature. Now, is happiness something that is open-ended, or is it to do with our relations to other people? If happiness is a relative issue, then doubling everyone's income will not change relativities and leave everyone as happy or unhappy as before. So it's a waste of time trying to increase it by economic means if we don't change relativities. W.S. Gilbert found a nice way of saying this. When everybody is somebody, then nobody is anybody. So you don't get much benefit from if everyone is increasing their income at the same time. I've already talked about the hedonic treadmill. Another aspect of this is that we get used to happiness. We get habituated to happiness. This is a general feature. So happiness does not last. There is a reversion to a set point, to a psychological set point, and so any increase is dissipated quite quickly. So this is useful to know. People are happy, but they're insatiable in the sense that their happiness goes down if it does not get stimulated all the time. So we can see this in this very simple graph. This measures both income and happiness on the same scale, and this is a time graph. So let's take income, which remains steady for 2 years and then jumps. What happens to happiness? Happiness also jumps, but then starts to dissipate. Yes, this is the habituation story. Very simple illustration of this. So does money buy happiness for poor countries but not for rich ones? Happiness, remember, all in that sense. Within countries, higher income produces more happiness. There's no question about it. So if you improve your relative position, you also increase your happiness. In rich countries, vast majority of people are either describe themselves, this is all we have, how people describe themselves, either as happy or as very happy. There is a small minority that are or describe themselves as unhappy. The predictors of unhappiness are robust. Unemployment, loneliness, separation, minority ethnicity, mental disorder. This is just an observation on current times, so we're likely to see an increase of unhappiness if we're going into a recession. And the general conclusion from this is that materialism is weaker than social connection. And those who write about it say maybe materialism is experienced as a substitute for social connection and is not perhaps a very good substitute for social connection. The advertisers try to persuade you that they love you, but that is a poor substitute for the real thing. Okay, this is a little piece of research that I've done myself, which I started it by trying to show the asymmetry of gain and loss. So what this shows is you have a scale here. I measured all these countries World Value Survey, 40,000 observations, individual observations. Now, this is the mean, or this is the central point, and this is what we're measuring here is the percentage of people who say they're very happy. So this is a measurement of less than the mean, and this is a measurement of more than the mean. And the first thing to see is that if you're in the upper income third, then you are a little happier. If you're in the lower income third, you're twice as unhappy as the people who are in the upper income third are happy. So this is the asymmetry of gain and loss. But the really interesting story here, I think, is all the rest. It's the country variable. And here you don't really find the countries that you expect in the right place. So what are the happiest places? Mexico and Venezuela. Latin America in general seems to be inexplicably happy. Things there can't be that jolly, but they put a good face on things, at any rate when they answer these questions. And you know, some of the countries here are the ones you'd expect, Netherlands, Denmark, Canada, Ireland and so on. But on the other side, you see some strange countries like Germany, Italy, you know, where are those jolly Italians? So what this tells us is that really there's a great deal that we don't know about this business. And these are the effects of society, history, culture, which go into explaining these scores, but which we can't really say very much about. Sorry. Okay, that's relative income. So, should government promote happiness? First answer is no. Most people are already happy or very happy, and it would take a very powerful intervention to make them any happier because they're so high up that scale. So it seems to be a waste of time, really, to make everyone happy. This is a graph I showed before. Happiness is not responsive to economic growth. It's not responsive to levels of income. So it's not really a worthy topic, a worthy target for government intervention. Increases in satisfactions are short-lived. There is suffering when growth declines. So that suggests that the prime objective should be economic growth and not happiness. That's a fairly conventional approach, skeptical approach, but possibly yes. And on the other side, First, the status race is wasteful. I showed that happiness is to a considerable extent a positional good. There's an argument that this is very wasteful. For every gainer, there's a loser. If there's more pain than gain for a dollar, yes, a dollar gain is worth only half of a dollar's loss, then the increase in happiness is bought at a large cost in unhappiness. Losing is stressful on other dimensions. Inequality is associated with deprivation on many dimensions. I don't need to tell you that in Glasgow. So there's a lot to be said for mitigating inequality. One of the things that can be done, if we're thinking about relative rewards, then reward people with gongs rather than with BMWs. That would be much cheaper. There's a long-standing, I don't know how many academics there are here, but there's a long-standing tradition in the British universities to give people a title which does not involve an increase in pay. That's the reader title. And in Oxford we have professorships of that type. So gongs are quite cheap, so long as we don't overuse them. That's the trick. Another idea which has quite a lot of currency is to tax positional expenditure. If all that matters is relative standing, then we can tax we can tax the BMWs, yes? without any great loss to anyone, because people will still have higher status. My favorite is to tax to target unhappiness rather than happiness. Happiness is intractable. There are many views about happiness. Contrary to Tolstoy, you remember Tolstoy said all happy families are the same and happy families are all different. I think it's the opposite in a sense. Unhappiness affects much smaller number of people, and there are targeted interventions which can make a big difference. So my reading of the happiness debate in terms of policy is that this is where we should focus our efforts if we do want to affect the happiness variable. But that's not so simple. For example, we know that unemployment affects people's well-being about five times more strongly than inflation. Yes, the ill-being that unemployment generates is about five times stronger than the ill-being that's generated by inflation. So that suggests immediately that we should target unemployment. However, if you think about it for a moment, inflation probably affects more than five times as many people as unemployment, as those affected by unemployment. So in terms of the total effect, maybe inflation should be a prior target to unemployment. So you can see that this is not so simple. Another idea is to focus on mental health. The incidence of mental ill health, I should say, the incidence of mental ill health is about the same as the incidence of unhappiness, and there's reason to think that there's a big overlap between the two. And in fact, in the government's initiatives, say Lord Laird, although he speaks about promoting happiness, in terms of policy he actually focuses very much on unhappiness, and in particular on mental health. And finally, there's this view which originates with Schopenhauer, that maybe we should seek to escape the status race. And possibly the best escapes from the status race are art and reflection, art and philosophy, art, education, philosophy. So things like Buddhism or things like culture, these are things that we might wish to promote as alternatives, alternative sources of satisfaction to the status race. In recent years there's been a new candidate trying to probe a little more deeply into what happiness is about, what authentic happiness is. Yes, I spoke about happiness in quotation marks as responses to survey questionnaires. That's not terribly satisfying. And some psychologists in the United States have been busily reinventing the wheel and investigating what authentic happiness might consist of. There's this movement which is called positive psychology. The big name here is Martin Seligman. And they've identified happiness as the exercise of virtue. I won't go into this, but I'll list them also: wisdom and knowledge, courage, humanity, justice, temperance, transcendence. You can see how these things are uplifting aspirations, is perhaps a term to use here. And they've related these virtues to the happiness score. And they've identified three lifestyles. One is simply aspiring to positive emotion. That's the hedonic aspiration, the pleasant life, if you wish. The other is engagement. Engaging in something gives you a sense of worth, sense of value, and so on. The engaged life. The third is meaningful, meaning the meaningful life. And this, I say they've reinvented the wheel because this goes back to the very beginning of happiness discourse, to the Aristotelian notion that happiness is the exercise of virtue over the complete life. And there is a concept here which I won't even try to pronounce. But at any rate, that's a really very old established idea of what happiness might be. And this has been taken up with a certain amount of enthusiasm as a positive policy. It's only just beginning because our knowledge of it is not very great. So this is a kind of government therapeutic intervention. I'd like to remind you of Norman Vincent Peale's, the original self-help book, Norman Vincent Peale's book, The Power of Positive Thinking. This smacks a lot of that kind of idea. So it's really a form of social conditioning. One aspect of this is the government's promotion of cognitive behavior therapy. But they're also positive interventions. So the most effective positive intervention has turned out to be three good things in your life. Think of three good things that happened to you today. Write them down. Ask yourself how they affected your life. It turns out that if you do this on a systematic basis, then you score higher, considerably higher, on the happiness scale than if you have some kind of placebo intervention. So it's a bit of confusion here, I think. And Wellington College, the £24,000 annual fee there, also buys you courses in happiness. The Young Foundation has extended this to the other end of the scale. So they have this local well-being project on Manchester estates, and they're trying to teach people from deprived estates how to, the power of positive thinking, how to inculcate emotional resilience, how to immunize them against unhappiness and depression. This is just beginning. I'll just flag some issues that arise out of this. One is virtue an end or a means? Is it something that's instrumental, or is it a goal in itself? I don't think the people involved in this ask themselves that question. What can motivate and get, in a consumer society where everyone is pursuing their own interests, what can motivate engagement? What can you interest people in? It seems to me that virtue is a communitarian concept. It relates to people's interaction with other people, to norms of interaction with other people. Happiness is a liberal notion. It's a notion of maximizing self-regarding pleasure, if you wish. So there is a tension here which the technical psychologists haven't given a great deal of thought to. Is engagement always in a good cause? We can think of engagements in rather unpleasant type of activities. Football hooliganism is something that comes to mind, but I'm sure you can think of others. And finally, take those exercises in the Manchester estates. Should we teach people to tolerate what is intolerable, or should we try to motivate them to change it? These are all issues that I have, but at any rate, I thought I'd mention this as an intervention that's currently in vogue. Now, I'd like to say something about my own approach. My own approach arises from the idea that happiness is related to the issue of self-control. These lines are the very first lines of my book. I say affluence breeds impatience. Impatience undermines well-being. I thought I'd give a Scottish authority here. So David Hume says there's no quality in human nature which causes more fatal errors in our conduct than that which leads us to prefer whatever is present to the distant and remote. Now, this is very interesting because he says this is a quality of human nature. This is not a result of bad information. It's not an issue of being properly informed. We actually have an intrinsic bias to prefer the short term over the long term. Now, there's been a lot of research about this in the last 30 years, and that research has uncovered what we might call a wired-in cognitive bias to prefer the present over the future. I'd like to show you a very simple diagram which illustrates this. This is a kind of optical analog of the way our mental preferences operate. So here again, back to the 18th century theme, and you can see this gentleman who has two payoffs. Yes, there's a £100 payoff, and there's a £120 payoff, which is slightly more remote. And it's quite obvious that 120 is better than 100, and that is how the gentleman perceived this. Now, let's move him a little closer to the payoff. Yes, he's moving closer. So you can see what happens. The preferences are reversed. If you look at the color of the rays, you can see that the brown ray, which is inferior here, becomes superior when it becomes closer. This is just an optical analog to the dynamics of the hedonics of desire, if you wish. Now, I have a feeling that you don't want the technical or more technical account of this, so I'll just go through this very quickly. The main point about this is that you can get a preference reversal if your model of perceiving the future is different from the standard economic one. In the standard economic model, you always prefer, if you prefer A to B now, you'll always prefer A to B. In this alternative model, which is called hyperbolic discounting, you will prefer A to B when they are remote, but when they come closer, there is a preference reversal. Now, the research, the psychological research, suggests that this is our natural mode of perceiving the future, that it requires an effort to perceive the future rationally, if you wish, consistently, if you wish. Now, what are the consequences of that? Consequence is that there is a problem. If we want to sacrifice something now for the sake of something better later, then our mindset gets in the way. We call that the commitment problem. The second is calculation is intractable. I won't go into the details of this, but what this means is that it's actually impossible to say what is better for us because we prefer different things at different times. And it's not clear why the present self should try to lock in the future self, why the interests of the present self should dominate over those of the future self. It's not even clear that it's possible. There's no algorithm available. Those with an economic background know that economics is about optimization, subject to budget constraints. Well, there's no algorithm. Once we accept that that's how we perceive the future, there's no algorithm that's available to calculate the optimum. That's actually very worrying from an analytical point of view. So what do we do? It doesn't mean that we don't choose. Choice becomes very difficult in these circumstances. It doesn't mean that we don't choose. We fall back on tried and tested commitment solutions. Yes, society has already gone through these issues, has come up with solutions that work. Things like education, insurance, marriage, these are commitment devices. When we don't know what to do next, we look around and see what other people do. We do like them, and most of the time, that's a good thing to do. And finally, that tells us something about the role of government. The role of government is to act as a commitment agent for society. Commitment agent for individuals and commitment agent for society. In other words, to promote the long term over the short term. Let me give you an example. Eating is a commitment problem. It illustrates the issue, yes. Our appetites tell us that we would like another helping of dessert, but we also like to be slim. So this is a conflict. This is called time inconsistency, and there's no clear solution to this. But we know what the outcomes of this struggle have been in the last 30 or 40 years. This measures body weight on the body mass index scale, and I won't go into the details. The white ones are Britain. The black ones are the United States, and you can see that there's been a relentless increase. This 25 BMI is supposed to be the upper limit of a healthy body weight. And Britain has only been about 5 years behind the United States in the increase of body weight. So this is a demonstration of the breakdown of, or not the breakdown, of a shift towards short-term rewards. Perhaps as a consequence of exposure to the affluent society, to exposure to the temptations of advertising, the marketplace, fast food, and so on. Now, why? Why is this thing been happening? It's been happening on a larger scale with other phenomena. In this case, let's stick with this example. Novelty overwhelms existing commitment devices. So in the past, if you wanted to eat a square meal, you had to go home, and then maybe your wife would cook it. I'm talking about the 1950s. By definition, she is no more than an average cook. So there's a limit to how appetizing this might be. Now, fast food overcomes these problems. Suddenly we have food, appetizing food, 24/7. It overwhelms existing commitment devices. It introduces a myopic bias and habituation. So although we respond to these short incentives, habituation means that we don't enjoy it very much. And without the protection of commitment devices, we get exposed to swamping and habituation. For example, club music. So I couldn't go into a club unprotected because my ears would explode. But people who go there every week presumably build up a certain amount of tolerance. Another example is McDonald's hamburgers, which have been rising in size together with their customers. And hence, that is one explanation for the paradox of happiness, of rising income but stagnant well-being, which we saw before. And that suggests that the problem is not the standard economic problem of maximizing consumption, but how to actually slow it down, how to pace it, how to pace the tempo of consumption to our capacity to digest it. Under affluence, scarcity is what is scarce. Yes, so we need to somehow make things a little less tempting than they are. And the objective is some optimal flow of psychic reward. Yes, some level at which I'm not saying that that's the only objective. That's an objective that's found in the literature. There are quite a few people who write that the trick is to find a pace which maximizes the hedonic flow of satisfaction. So what is government for? Government, on this view, there are other reasons why we have governments, but this is another angle. Indeed, I'm going to talk tomorrow about another perspective on government, which also arises from these time preference issues. So you can think of government as helping to solve commitment problems. First, if choice were easy, if choice were automatic, as economists tell us, there would be no need for any social intervention, but we have very big states. And the problem, one problem here is that of internality. This is an analog to the economic concept of externality, of harm to others. Concept of internality is that of harm to ourselves. If choice is fallible, then not only children need the nanny state, possibly adults need a nanny as well from time to time. So there is a concept of optimal paternalism which even economists are beginning to take on. Actually, some of Obama's closest advisors have been promoting this idea of optimal paternalism. There's this book which made a bit of a stir called Nudge by Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler, which actually expressed these ideas. I don't want to say I was there before, but we thought about it at the same time. Okay, things like drink driving, yes? So, drink driving, we can't judge, we can't trust ourselves, and the more we drink, the less we can trust ourselves, so we have some kind of external regulation which keeps us honest, provides us a stopping rule. I won't go into this tax on cigarettes. That's a famous crucial experiment in which a tax on people were actually happier when they paid a tax on cigarettes because it helped them to solve their self-control problem. Why doesn't the government simply give out money? Why does it distribute goods in kind? There are lots of these goods in kind. In the UK, for example, housing benefit is given only for housing. Why doesn't it give out cash? In the United States, food stamps. And if you think this is only for the poor, well, free education. Why do we have free education or free health? Why don't we just get money to go out and buy these things? And the reason is that we cannot trust ourselves to spend it on the right things. So that's at any rate, that embodies the judgment of society, that that's the case. Mandatory saving, national insurance or social security, and even conservatives don't act on their own nanny state rhetoric, and they advocate various constraints which are listed there. Here's an example. Sorry. This is research that I've been doing very recently. Again, back on obesity. So there's a difference in obesity depending on welfare regimes. This is the percentage obese. These are the Nordic countries. You can see about 14%. Continental is the continental European welfare states, about the same. And the market liberal states have significantly higher levels of obesity. So, free markets seem to make you fat. How exactly that works, you know, if anyone wants to pursue this further, I'm happy to answer questions about it. There is a hypothesis there. But at any rate, countries with heavy behavioral intervention, heavy government intervention, seem to be doing better on that front. Okay. Rationality, myopia, commitment, I want to describe different visions of well-being, depending on whether we take myopia seriously or not. Myopia suggests different types of interventions to those suggested by the standard efficient markets, rational choice approaches. Markets satisfy demand for arousal, so we can trust markets to satisfy our needs for arousal. This is a fairly short-term type of reward, and they'll do it well. But the creative destruction of markets undermines the sense of security, and we can think of government as a commitment agent whose job is to cope with the effects of creative destruction. One example is the pay-as-you-go pensions which government provides. I stress pay-as-you-go as opposed to the alternatives of private pensions which are based on long-term contracts with private providers. I'll talk about why that is preferable tomorrow. Education. The choice between myopic efficiency and long-term intrinsic motivation. These are, again, two types of perspectives that are suggested by different cognitive orientations. The rational orientation and the myopic orientation. Labor markets. race to the bottom of the so-called flexible labour market, whereas, for example, the Nordic high-wage road. Parenting, that is a policy which arises from the myopic perspective that says that parents will not necessarily do the right thing without help, that they need help in order to do their job. There are various issues to do with gambling, drinks, drugs, smoking. We've seen how New Labour in the last 10 years has gone down the permissive road in all of these areas, and this arises from the notion that consumers can be trusted to look after themselves. Restrictions reflect the myopic orientation, the idea that people need to be nudged to avoid these internalities. Okay, there's a whole list of things here which I won't go into because I'm running out of time. And so to conclude, what is the role of government from that point of view? In the short term, I'd say target, if you want to act on happiness, target unhappiness rather than happiness. In the long term, to promote well-being, focus on the long term, which is difficult for individuals to achieve and which is beyond the reach of markets. And that's the subject also of my talk tomorrow. So thank you very much.
Ideas in question. So if you have a question, just raise your hand in the time honoured manner and say who you are before you ask a question, kind of where you're from, so that we can know where you're coming from. That would be really helpful.
Just wondering if you can hear me, not going to lose your voice, I'm going to try to hear. You said at the outset there, always to decide governments actually want to keep us happy. There's the recent, what we don't know, series in BBC2 some months ago, which contained quite persuasively that the governments actually want to keep us in a permanent state of anxiousness. And in the meantime, people at the Oliver James School who are arguing much the same thing in the consumer field, in the marketing, the consumerism, which you touched on again there, keeps us in a perpetual up in station of avoidance. We have previous time that we had Oliver James speaking with us, and I sense what he's actually saying is he takes it even further. And he's saying that marketing like consumerism actually dissipates and erodes the individual's capacity to sense and value and enjoy true and make it authentic happiness. Would you go as far as that? And does marketing like consumerism then become one of your targets for unhappiness?
Okay, there are two questions here. One is about government inculcating fear. I think it's one of the paradoxes of the last 30-40 years that on the one hand we've been exposed to a rhetoric and a climate of rugged individualism, standing on our own 2 feet, self-reliance and so on, markets know best. On the other hand, the assumptions that government should be looking after us have been stronger than ever. So when market institutions collapse, they run straight to government. And government acknowledges that everyone is looking to it for salvation. So I think that the assumption of reliance on the welfare state has run much deeper than this market rhetoric has been trying to do. Now, I think that the issue about fear is a good point. But to some extent, we are being frightened so that we can look out for comfort from our protectors. So I think that that ties in with this theme. In a sense, we're being threatened so that we look for security to government once again. The second issue is, do I think that markets undermine happiness? There is a literature about this. I think the best work is done by an American psychologist, Tim Kasser, And he also summarizes a lot of other work. So the argument is that, first, that people with a materialist life orientation score lower on happiness scales. That's a direct observation. Now, why that is the case, that is a little more speculative. And the argument is the one I mentioned in my lecture, that people are looking to commodities for emotional satisfaction which they cannot provide, because they are deprived in they don't have the kind of emotional support that they would otherwise like. For my own part, I can see a division of labor there, and I think it'd be wrong to go to the other extreme. The issue is that, again, this is the issue of arousal. So satisfaction requires a certain level of arousal. Here again I'm invoking a particular psychological literature. So that's slightly above our set point, just to keep us active, as it were. But the point is how to keep that in balance. In terms of institution, my sense of this is that markets provide our short-term satisfactions very well. For a variety of reasons, they are not well structured to provide long-term satisfactions. Long-term satisfactions essentially require prior investment for the long term, and markets are inhibited from doing this by 16 bullet points. You know, there's a whole range of arguments why markets don't do that very well. So I wouldn't say let's get rid of markets, but the issue is how to find the balance, and that is both a personal issue for everyone. One of the interesting things about this issue is that to some extent this is a personal problem that every one of us faces. You know, we can go to a money website and find the best insurance deal or the best mortgage. There's no website that will find the optimal level of arousal for us, so the optimal level of happiness. This is something we have to work out for ourselves. But there's also the institutional issue of what are the things we should ask the market to do, what are the things we should ask other agencies to do. Well, I'm always a little worried about anything that requires a radical restructuring, because it's not going to happen very soon. And if it does happen, possibly not in a form which we would approve of. Now, my solution to this, I entirely accept that governments are as short-sighted as their citizens, politicians are just as short-sighted as private individuals. And this is the little twist which I'll elaborate in more detail tomorrow. Government actually achieves long-term purposes by not attempting to do that, but by operating on a pay-as-you-go basis. I've actually worked out that about four-fifths of what government does is to deliver on remote or contingent obligations. Things like intergenerational transfers, old age, education, contingent obligations like unemployment or health, things of that sort. But it doesn't write a long-term contract. It does this by meeting immediate needs. And that, in a sense, solves this problem of foresight. It doesn't have to do a lot of foresight. This is a kind of technical twist, but I think it's extremely important in understanding why we find government doing what it is doing at this point in historical time. This is something that we've discovered over time and are in fairly secure possession of now. So that's, I'm sure this isn't not entirely satisfying, But that is a clue as to how I see this problem being resolved.
As you say, the research on happiness related to it is very well established, and it doesn't take away the fact that happiness and satisfaction are seriously bad indicators. I mean, the number of times I've seen surveys over the years of people who have made a great deal of people dissatisfied with something, but people almost always say they're satisfied, something like saying they're wrong. So do you think the question would be, do you think you could take some of those other dimensions of which you will be able to get a better measure of happiness?
First, I'd like to take issue with the argument that happiness is seriously misleading. We have to bear in mind what it is that it tells us. So it's actually quite reliable in that, first, we know that in poor countries, on the whole, people say that they're unhappy or less happy than they are in rich countries. The unemployed say that they are deeply unhappy. The determinants are actually very robust. We come up with the same coefficients. This has been done for scores of thousands of times and different countries, and turns up pretty much the same results. What you could say is that the wisdom it teaches us is limited, but I think that any wisdom we can get is better than ignorance. So in that respect, I think it is quite useful. So for example, the finding that it is difficult to raise people's reported subjective well-being is actually quite happy. Quite useful. Otherwise, we might be tempted to invest in raising that indicator. Should we go into other measures? There are all sorts of variants of this. For example, in the States, they've been trying to get around to generate. There's an issue, for example, of, again, time gets into this. So the standard economic measure of well-being is actually choice, consumer choice. Now, choice is not something you experience, it's the anticipation of experience. So at the moment of choice, when you buy something, you anticipate enjoyment. So what you're measuring is what people expect to experience. Then there's a finding of how people experience satisfactions that they've already had. Again, I think this is a very interesting finding. So when people are asked, was this a good experience, was this a bad experience, it turns out that they have two measures. One is the peak experience, and the other is the terminal experience. It's a combination of these. So the way people recollect happiness is different from the way they actually experience it or the way they choose it. In fact, you can manipulate this to make people prefer more pain over less pain. Or for example, when I sit my students, I ask them to evaluate my course, I draw on this knowledge and choose a point in the course which is both the peak experience and the terminal experience, and I get very high satisfaction scores. So there's been an attempt to actually monitor people while they are experiencing things. So they get wired and they're asked at random intervals, how are you feeling now? And they press a button and that goes to a computer and so on. But that actually privileges the immediate experience. Are we going to get rid of anticipations? Are we going to rid of memories? That strikes me as a pretty doubtful approach. So on the whole, I'd agree with you that it would be nice to know more about happiness. I'm rather dubious on measuring happiness because I do think there are very many ways to happiness. Many different ways in which people can be satisfied. I think that the opposite is actually easier to capture. Pain is experienced in a similar way by most people. Deprivation, I think, is experienced in a similar way. So I would invest more in identifying deprivation and its sources than trying to understand. Happiness, I think, is a matter for poets, philosophers, artists. I even said that in the talk. not the highest priority for a measurement effort.
Hi. I wonder if I could ask you to reflect on your own discipline on economics and this desire to measure and to re-measure and to use these calculators. Because you talked about eudaimonia and the Greeks' attempt to work out what the new life is. And you say that governments are have this role of getting commitment devices, but commitment devices like universal education, social housing, and the health service arose from a consciousness amongst the population as much as it did from a political initiative. In short, what I'm saying is that although these concepts of the good life, what we want from the good society, are hard to define, hard to pin down, good things happen when a society gets together and works out some of these things and commit themselves to it. In other words, it's a much softer, messier process than the precision of measurement. Is that not what we should be more concerned with? The dialogue, the debate, the movement towards that that's desirable in the messy way that humans evolve with that?
I see a more immediate priority in engaging with the opposite view. In the last 30, 40 years, the dominant mindset, the dominant doctrine in the social sciences, certainly in economics, has been the theory of rational choice and its variants. Theory of rational choice is a radical break with the Western ethical tradition. Virtually all previous ethical doctrines have been either other-directed or had some conception of the common good. I think people don't sufficiently realize what the radical break rational choice is in that respect, in that it identifies self-regard as the only legitimate objective of action. This is really something quite extreme. It's an amoral doctrine. Some people would say it's an immoral doctrine. And I think that part of our problem is that we've really lost the language not only for identifying individual well-being or individual satisfaction, but for identifying the common purpose. Because rational choice really leaves no room for any common purpose. Sometimes it pretends to pursue the common purpose, but really there's no theoretical underpinning for that. So I think there's a lot of pushing back that needs to be done. Personally, I'm very much on your side. But in terms of policy, it seems to me that there's a great deal to unwind there, that there is a doctrine which is the central policy norm, which is one of the mysteries of this whole business, is why it caught on so quickly and so totally in the social sciences, where you think there wouldn't be any particular vested interest. It is a doctrine of vested interest. It is a doctrine of the haves rather than the have-nots, yes?
I mean, I agree with you entirely. That is the problem. But I don't see how you're going to find econometric mindset with more measurement, more analysis. Surely it needs a different type of perspective to keep the very phenomenon
in Europe. Okay, I can't say that I've... You know, we can actually go back a bit, because even as recently as 30, 40 years ago, even doctrines like welfare economics had a conception of the common good. That conception of the common good is a fairly thin one, agreed, but nevertheless, there was an acknowledgement of the public good. Before that, utilitarianism, for example, has quite a strong notion of the common good. So I think that we need to really go back and try to recapture a bit of that and perhaps go forward and try to redefine or recapture what that public good consists of. And it's interesting that policy has never completely abandoned the common good. You know, government policy is not only motivated by vote winning, as rational choice people would like us to believe, but there is, at any rate, the pretension of pursuing the common good. But I think this has had, this doctrine has done serious damage to policy making, in that it's confused people about what they're about, and that civil servants have been told, well, forget about the common good, what you need is to meet targets, to score highest. The only way to motivate your subordinates is to hold out the carrots before them. They have no other conception of duty, for example. So I think that there is quite a rich, let's put it this way. One of the things about rational choice is that it is psychologically incorrect. It's descriptively incorrect. That's not the way we're wired to think about other people. It actually takes an effort, I think, to think that way. So, one way of thinking about this is that one of our highest, the standard rational choice model invites us to rank our preferences. Well, one of the highest preferences which we all share is the good opinion of other people. So we're not independent. It's not the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory type of world. It's a world in which we try to get the good opinion of others, and we get that good opinion by giving them ours. So the standard model is a reciprocal one rather than a self-regarding one. I think a true psychological model. And it's also untrue at other levels, because the other dimension of the rational choice doctrine is the invisible hand doctrine, namely that markets are efficient, that markets will lead us towards benign equilibria, that markets will provide us the best possible outcomes. Well, what you're never told, this is presented as a scientific truth, but what you're never told is that this is a logical statement. Yes, that every individual pursuing their own interests will produce the common good. As a logical statement, it has never been proven. It's been on the table for 250 years. It's been proven in an extremely restrictive form, the two theorems of welfare economics, which are completely unrealistic. But as one of the actually authors of this doctrine says, this is almost a refutation. Yes, that in fact we have no scientific demonstration. We might have empirical experience that says that markets work better than other systems at other times, but the idea that markets are naturally self-regulating has never been proven. It's an article of faith. So I think that these two related doctrines, which have governed our lives for the last 30, 40 years, are both scientifically unfounded.
This is an area of paradoxes that more money beyond a certain level doesn't get you to happiness. And I'm maybe just coming at Phil's question by a different angle. It leads me to wonder, given what you said, if happiness is so tied up with our social connections and commitment devices of various kinds, is government or our government good authors of those commitments, devices. I tend to support what Phil is saying. I wonder whether the most effective commitment devices don't come by us looking upwards, but by us all looking around ourselves and through the collective wisdom, appropriate behaviour to rise to that regards to the service and collective people.
Well, it really depends on what kind of level. My observation is essentially an empirical one, to say that despite the hegemony of market doctrines, the state has never been larger. And we've seen a whole range of activities and areas where the state acts as a commitment device. The state underpins education. The state underpins medical treatment. The state underpins old age. Are there better ways of doing this? Well, if there are, we haven't seen them so far. I have a...
rest the issue slowing down and driving forward. It doesn't seem to me that the government is going to be
Well, divorce is an interesting issue because there are two sides to it. You could argue that, yeah. Well, apologies. You could argue that divorce is actually represents an increase in welfare. In that, now people who are previously trapped in unhappy unions find a way out into liberty. Again, partly it depends on how you frame the choice. So if you think it's a rational choice, then we know, for example, that in economic terms, women are much worse off for a while after divorce. So you can say this loss that the woman experienced, by the way, men also experience a loss, economic loss after divorce, that the loss that is experienced must be smaller than the pain that has been avoided. Yes, it represents, it's a measure of what has been gained. If you frame it in myopic terms, then you can say that people have felt the distress of the unhappy union, but have not been able to anticipate the cost that goes into it. I'm agnostic on this particular issue. I think the really interesting issue arises in the case of children. Because although the partners to the union may or may not be increasing their well-being, the children are part of the story, but they haven't signed the contract. They haven't made the choice. And what we do see is that there has been, first that divorce is associated with an increasing probability of detriments, a range of detriments. By the way, the increase is not that enormous. It's not that every child of divorce is destined to suffer, and the increase is not that enormous, but since the numbers are very large, there is actually quite a lot of suffering there. And there's another issue as to whether there is a self-reinforcing process there. This, again, I discuss this in some detail in the book. So the argument is that, how shall I put it? It's to do with... I forget the term. Bowley, what's the name of his theory? Attachment theory, yes. So it's to do with attachment theory. So the argument is that if you're deprived from good quality attachment as a child, you are inhibited in your attachment capacity as an adult, and therefore there's a risk that you will transmit this to your children and you can have an increasing spiral. There's some evidence to support this. There's some evidence to support, again, that the incidence of mental disorder increases in market societies. That's another. That's related to the obesity story. I actually write about this in the book. But that doesn't mean, you know, it could well be that the disorder in the family is not the cause in itself, but itself a reflection of the pressures of the market system on the family itself. That the loosening of the family is itself a response to an enlargement of opportunities outside the family, so a competition between the family economy and the market economy, which partly has these outcomes. If you're looking for a policy angle on this, my policy angle on this would be to help parents. Because I think we all depend on a supply of good quality children coming through, if only to provide our pensions.